Stand by for action. Anything can happen in the next half hour.
AO Zone's Greatest Hits, Volume 2.
Hi, my name's Carolyn Bailey, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to AO Zone's Greatest Hits, Number 2. Every 10 podcasts or so, we'll present highlights for these Greatest Hits packages. In the first 10 podcasts, we had some great discussions and featured some wonderful guests, and the same is true of our second set of 10 podcasts. AO Zone stands for Rational Discourse within the Animal Advocacy Movement. We aim to inform, to educate, and also to challenge many of the views in the movement from our vegan-based abolitionist perspective. So please, sit back and enjoy AO Zone's Greatest Hits, Number 2. In podcast 11, Jordan Wyatt, the presenter of the Coexisting with Non-Human Animals podcast, talked about his chicken friends and how people often talk about chickens.
I want to cut to the chase really now, because I know for a fact that the question that most AO Zone members are going to want us to ask you, Jordan, is how's the chicken friends?
They are good. It's 7 at night at the moment, which is kind of spoiling things when you set it at firm time.
They're settling down, are they?
Yeah, I was going to say I put them to sleep, but then I sort of realised how that sounds as well. I have to be careful here. I put them away. I closed the
door.
That
sounds just
them.
As bad.
So many negative sounding things just to say that you tuck your chicken friends in for bed in the night. They happily nest themselves in the chicken shed, and they have a lot of straw, and they have a beam that they like to sleep up high on, about 2 metres off the ground. And each night they put themselves in there, and I close the door on them nicely with lots of pats and promises to open it up again in the morning. And sometimes I think they maybe think, he's never going to come back for us. So they go to sleep as the sun goes down, and they'll be waiting for me to open in the morning, and they've got plenty of food and water, and I always like giving them some chickweed late at night. I always think if they need a midnight snack, as it were. So they're safe and warm at the moment.
Jordan, how did you come to have chickens friends to begin with? How did that start?
Well, my father decided to get them, and they were just sort of a spur of the moment thing. Oh, it'd be nice to have some little chickens sort of peeping around the backyard. It'd be sort of picturesque. He was never really interested in them, and I'm living here by myself at the moment, and they're great company. They're easy to care for, and so it was his idea that he probably, I believe, the wonderful Barbara DeGrand, and she has Veganacious, veganacious.com. She had a previous podcast episode talking about people in sort of suburbs of America where they like peacocks and ducks, and they seem to import birds to sort of complete the scene as sort of ornaments or furniture. And I believe my father just thought that chickens would be nice to have in the backyard. Probably a cheap way of getting eggs too.
It's tragic, really, isn't it, in the sense that, you know, most people's attitude towards chickens is well, chicken really, isn't it, rather than chickens. So they tend to kind of just lump them all together, whereas if they actually experience them as individuals, they would see that they've got personalities and they've got, you know, moods, and I don't think most people appreciate that kind of thing. And so it must be particularly distressing to you to hear how the mainstream talk about chickens in general.
I think one of the hardest things for me is when I go to the supermarket, and every time I leave the house, I always check that they're okay, and they always are. And as soon as I go out there, they meet me. They don't always follow me around, but more, you know, most of the time, at least one of them will start to follow me, and they recognize me as one of their friends, is how I'd put it. They like me. They follow me around, whatever term you want to call it. That I always give them a pat and make sure they're well, and then I'll walk up to the supermarket with my reusable bags that have got sort of vegan all over them, and just to sort of be a walking billboard, I guess. And to go to the supermarkets, you have to walk through the meat section, as it's called, and to see otherwise really nice, friendly looking people, big smiles on their faces, going through sort of endless refrigerated shelves full of the dead bodies, and to see people looking at the chickens, and I always just think, sort of avoid eye contact and you'll get over it soon. And last time I was at the supermarket at Pack and Save, there was an elderly woman that was buying a whole bunch of chicken frames, is what they call it, and it's basically skeleton cartilage and a little bit of their muscle left on, and heaven only knows what the price was on this thing. It would have been, for what was left of each of these wonderful birds, they would have been you know, an American dollar each or something. And there was a whole bunch of them behind the clear plastic wrap. And I just wanted to say to her, you know, have you ever thought about how lovely chickens are? And I wanted to give her one of my business cards. And on the back, I've got a nice color picture of my chickens when they're a few days old, the chicks, and Mr. Rooster, the male, and Miss Hen, the female, mother and father and the family, and just they're not hurting anyone. They're just on a nice mossy rock in the sunlight and with clover around them, and the clover is basically taller than the couple day old chicks are. And just to say to her that, have you ever thought that these used to be beautiful other animals and they didn't hurt anyone, and why do we do this to other animals? But I don't think it would be very to work out very well being so confrontational with someone. It is difficult, but I think it's just important to stay positive and to think that we're working to help them by promoting veganism.
In podcast 15, Barbara asked Professor Oscar Horter about forms of vegan education, and Ronnie asked what has become his trademark question about veganism.
Oscar, I noticed on your transcript when you were on the guest chat for AirZone that you mentioned that creative vegan education was one of the best ways to reduce demand for animal products. But I'm wondering, what is your view on how to be effective in that role?
I don't know. It's very tricky. I mean, don't we all wonder about that? The main problem for that is that there are courses of action that have been traditionally run in order to achieve other ends. For instance, when people have done things like rescuing animals or introducing new legislation, I mean, they weren't trying to do vegan education, but rather to achieve different things. And now some people are wondering, well, maybe if we do, for instance, open rescues, we could, I mean, not just save the animals, but use this in order to, you know, create a an opportunity to educate the public about veganism. For instance, if some other people say, well, maybe if we try to forbid some use of animals, we could, that would give us the opportunity to convey against the vegan message. And I'm not completely sure about how good this works, though I'm open to try. So that's basically, I think, the main problem regarding this. Because for the rest, I mean, we know that there are things that, yeah, somehow work, but don't allow us sometimes to reach the masses. We know that doing things like putting stalls, doing 3D performances with pictures of animals and inviting people not to eat them and doing all these kind of things are good instruments to convey the bigger message. But the problem is when you want to be even more effective and you try to do something that allows you to reach the masses, and then you try other means such as the ones I've mentioned. I mean, I'm just thinking about this as I think many of us are.
How long have you been a vegan yourself, Oscar, and what was it that caused you to become vegan?
I've been a vegan since 1994, and what was the reason for it? I knew some people that were vegetarian and talked to me about the ways in which animals have been treated, but they weren't really conveying a clear message. I didn't get the information that I would like to give people in order to become vegan. And something I might say is that soon after I became a vegan, I happened to read Animal Liberation. And I recall this was like a huge thing for me, like a huge discovery, because then I found all the arguments there that I didn't have before. So before it was basically a thing, an issue of compassion. I mean, I hadn't really thought very, very deeply about this. I didn't know what speciesism was. I didn't really have an idea of what animal rights was either. And I recall that when I read Animal Liberation, it was like, now I understand it. And now I have a basis. So it really reinforced my veganism. And the funny thing was that after some years, I also became convinced that Animal Liberation wasn't really such a good book, and that I disagreed with Singer on several counts. Yeah, well, that's basically how it was.
In podcast 14, when we interviewed Robin Lane, the co-founder of the London Vegan Festival, I mentioned that here in Australia, the word vegan is still often regarded as a no-go area. I asked Robin about that and whether using the word vegan had been a problem in terms of his work in Britain. This led to an interesting conversation about why some animal advocates are still wary of using the V word.
Certainly nowadays, the word vegan is pretty well known, and I think, you know, you go into a restaurant, for instance, and you mention the word vegan. In the past, they wouldn't have known what you were talking about, but I think now it's just a very generally recognised word. Yeah, calling it the London Vegan Festival doesn't actually put people off at all, and we always get in excess of 2,000 people turn up to the festival. We've never had, apart from at the beginning, we never had actually less than that. So, yeah, the word vegan is actually a generally accepted word now.
That's the experience that I've had in Ireland, actually, Robin. The experience on the street is the same as you're suggesting there, which is that people know what the term means and that they're not put off by it particularly. There's still many national groups who still want to try to, you know, they do that kind of, you know, vegan, the vegan stroke vegetarian type thing. Now, why do you think there's a reluctance just to embrace veganism as a whole in the national groups?
I think people are still a little bit worried about this concept of putting people off, you know, by saying vegan. Maybe it does put some people off, but I think, you know, if it's vegan, then it should be said to be vegan and not hide behind, you know, other terms. Veganism, it certainly in this country, it's not just vegans and animal rights people that are promoting the word. It's also companies themselves are promoting the word vegan by actually saying on products like suitable for vegans, for instance. Various supermarkets like the Co-op or Sainsbury's, they actually say if something's vegan, it actually says it on the packet. So, you know, the general public are seeing that word now, whereas they wouldn't have done, say, 20 years ago. It would have been unheard of.
I agree. It seems like now is the time to start using that word a little bit more. People are familiar with the word, and it's a strange kind of movement where you don't really talk about what you're really promoting.
Absolutely. It seems more to be people within the movement who are more reluctant to use the word vegan than those outside of the movement.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's a shame, really, because, well, for instance, myself and Alison are involved in a group called Vegan Campaigns, and we do street stalls. And we get no end of people, you know, flooding up to the stalls, just ordinary members of the public. And we're promoting veganism all the time. You know, I think the important thing is to publicise the word vegan as much as possible, rather than using other words, which is meaning it's slower, you know, to come to people's attention.
It makes it harder to even find outreach literature. I'm in Texas in the United States, and I find it's hard. A lot of the major organizations print out affordable literature, but it all says vegetarian, and it makes it really hard to find. You pretty much have to find your own or develop your own if you want to say vegan because of that issue. It's really a shame. It seems short-sighted to me.
I think the problem with people saying veggie or vegetarian is that certainly in this country, in Britain, the word vegetarian now comes to mean not just what we think of being as vegetarian, but actually including animal products like fish and obviously dairy, but I mean, you know, people like say they're vegetarian if they eat fish, or even some people think they're vegetarian if they eat just white meat, you know, so that can lead to a whole lot of confusion by using the word veggie or vegetarian.
There are some animal advocates, especially in the States, and I always cite Carol Adams in this sense, who try in a sense to kind of reclaim vegetarian to mean vegan, really. But I think that it wouldn't really work in Europe, and certainly not in Britain, where vegetarian does certainly mean, as you say, very heavy on the dairy, and probably might include the eating of fishes and even the eating of chickens, for example. So I think the word vegetarian is kind of lost to us now, certainly on this side of the pond.
It means the same here, though, too, Roger.
Yeah, but not for everybody, though. That's that's the interesting thing, isn't it? You know, some people seem, I mean, you know, like the John Robbins idea about pure vegetarian means vegan. And, you know, so for some people, vegetarian means vegan, and then you've got the lacto-vegetarians and the ovo.
But vegetarian never means vegan because it's only about diet. I mean, to me, that's why it's so conflicted. It doesn't mean vegan. It means a plant-based diet for some people, but it never means vegan because it takes out the whole ethical piece.
Yeah.
We welcome the presenter of Wild Time Radio, Thomas Yannick, as our guest for Podcast 13. This is how he explained his shift from animal welfare to animal rights.
Okay, well, I started out having a human rights show before I had an animal rights show. And I lived in Ireland back then, and I noticed straight away when you use the term animal rights, there seemed to be some issues. People were very afraid of the term. So I settled for animal welfare as a term, because I also wasn't too clear really what that meant. Because back then, I really thought if I talk to people like, I don't know, you know, the my very first interview I did with a gentleman from of those sea aquariums, and thought, you know, if you could tell me something about how much pollution we have in the ocean. I didn't even really see the problem with animals in captivity, because I used to enjoy the zoo a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And gradually, as I started obviously to research that, it dawned on me what an idiot I was. it's really like, you know, you go to the zoo all your life and you never really question it. I started actually questioning it earlier, before I had the show, when I studied wolves. Really thought, okay, where do we have wolves in Ireland? Let's see. So I went to the zoo, and then obviously straight away noticed that they don't exhibit natural behavior. So gradually then I understood that I have to completely come from a different angle, because I noticed when I started to talk to people and they would tell me how great it is that they, for instance, breed animals in captivity. And I said, but you don't breed them to release them into the wild, because they can't fend for themselves. So it didn't make sense when they talked to me about conservation. And immediately I had some sort of issues with them, because they thought we're talking about welfare. And obviously, already in my mind, I had changed. And then after a while, I just said, like, you know, I don't care what people think the show should be. Let's do an animal rights show, or let's not have it at all. This is how Wild Time Online then came about, where I thought, if they don't have it, I can have my own little internet stuff. Well, that's why I thought I really have to change it. And then obviously, in the process of doing all this, I turned vegan. And then I thought, you know, from now on, it really has to really be about not using animals at all, be it for fashion, food, any industry whatsoever, and I'm pushing that ever since.
In this clip from Podcast 15, Ronnie asked Oscar Horta to explain the styles of activism that are occurring in Spain.
Oscar, can you tell us a bit more about the animal protection movement in Spain? Which are the main groups? What sort of activities do they carry out?
First of all, something that is very, very important to note is that, for instance, in the UK and in English-speaking countries, there is this culture of solidarity and giving to charities, but we don't have it in Spain. People aren't really used to donate to charities of any kind. I mean, they do, but this happens much less than in the UK. So this is something very, very important to realize how big the movement can be in Spain. It's very, very difficult for different organizations to get like public support, to get the big donations and all that. And they have very, very few members, very few people who donate to them. Plus, I mean, the movement is newer in Spain. The situation in Spain in the 90s, I think it was more or less like the one that was in the UK in the 70s or so. So we are like 20 years back from how the thing is in the UK. All this means that you don't have like very, very big organizations. Still, you have organizations with lots of support. So this is something that is like if the culture, the culture of the organizations, which you find in Spain and in the UK, is very, very different. Because, for instance, if you think about the big organizations in the UK, you have organizations with, or in the US for that matter, you have big organizations who have big budgets, and they would hire some people working for them, and they would do the work, and they will ask for donations. In Spain, there are very, very few people hired, very, very few, if any. They are very bad paid, actually. I remember when I was living in the UK, I lived there like 10 years ago, something like that. I was living in London, and I remember going to the meetings of London Animal Action then. You don't find anything such as London Animal Action as it was then in Spain. But rather what you find is that the organizations, how would I say, they make use of all these grassroots forces. So many activists are very, very like loyal to organizations, are very, very committed to one or another organization. This works in the case of what we could say the anti-speciesist organizations. So in Spain there are some animal welfare groups, not very important ones, who basically care about legislation, and some of them have some shelters and all that. And then when it comes to organizations that are more focused on animal rights, you could mention probably about maybe five groups. You have Equanimal and Animal Equality, Igualdad Animal, and these groups are the ones that are carrying out work such as investigation of how animals are treated. They are the ones who have been doing things such as hand sabbing in the case of Equanimal, open rescues, and this kind of actions. That is civil disobedience in order to convey a vegan message. And their message is clearly an anti-speciesist one. Then you have another group, which is Defense Animal. I mean, what they do is just vegan education through stalls in streets and events with placards and this kind of stuff. But they don't do any action such as civil disobedience action or any of the kind. But yet they have also an anti-speciesist message, such as Igualdad Animal and Equanimal. Then there is this other group, which is Anima Naturalis. And they are very much like PETA, although they are a much smaller group. And they work in different countries in Latin America and Spain. So they defend veganism, but they don't really use an anti-speciesist argumentation so much. And regarding the way in which they act, they are sort of like PETA. They try to use guerrilla marketing, and they sometimes use people naked and all that. And then you have also another group, which is called Libera, which means free, like free the animals. And they're based on changing legislation, basically. So they promote veganism, but they don't really focus too much in educating the public. They were the ones who were more strongly working for the abolition of bullfighting in Catalonia.
In podcast 16, Roger gave an account of an email he received while researching for his doctorate about people's attitudes to other animals. Listeners are invited to spot the verbal typo.
In 1999, I kind of put out a call on the internet asking people to recount some encounters, interaction with people about non-human animals, about how they react to so-called food animals and everything. I got this back. Listen to this. This is from the 3rd of August, 1999. And he said, "Dear Roger, further to yesterday's email, you might like to read the following, which is very indicative of mainstream attitude to food animals, in inverted commas, i.e. they are not animals. A few months back, I was with colleagues from London Animal Action. We had set up a stall in Angel Islington, consult the Monopoly Board for that, complete with posters and leaflets. Whenever people stopped to sign our petition, we invited them to help themselves to as many leaflets as they wanted. About the time when the school knocked off, we had a number of schoolgirls, about 13 or to 15 years old, signing. One group of about four started talking to us. Yes, they loved animals, and yes, it was cruel to put them in laboratories, circuses, etc. They took a few leaflets, then one noticed the leaflet entitled Eating Animals. Oh, look, some people eat animals. How gross, she said. You're vegetarian or vegan, are you? I asked. No, I'm not vegetarian, the one replied. Then you eat animals too. Of course I don't, but I'm not vegetarian, she said. But if you're not vegetarian, that means you eat animals. Vegetarianism means not eating animals, I persisted. No, I wouldn't eat animals. That's disgusting. Well, then you must be a vegetarian. No, I'm not. I eat meat, but I don't eat animals.
Oh, gosh.
By this time, my two friends were listening to this quite astounded. Well, let's put it this way, I said. Do you eat hamburgers and things? Yes, of course I do. We all do. But they're not made out of animals. What do you think that lump of mincemeat in the middle of the bun is? Lamb or cow or something, I guess, is the reply. Right, I said. And what are animals and cows? They're animals. No, they're not, the girls chorused. They're not proper animals. Animals are cats and dogs and things like that.
No, I said, animals are cows and lambs and pigs as well. Oh no, the first one said, you can't count them as animals. They're just things that taste good. The email ends with, that's what we're up against, Roger. I thought, geez, you know, this has got to go in the PhD because it's just, I mean, that, is that not just an incredible encounter in terms of that?
In podcast 11, Tim asked Jordan White about the issue of burnout since Jordan had heard a talk about it from Mark Hawthorne.
Jordan, you mentioned that you were interested in the talk that you heard on burnout, and I'm wondering if you can talk about how you see burnout from where you sit. Have you seen it or experienced it yourself?
Well, I've only been vegan a couple of years. I know of people who have just felt overwhelmed by the level of exploitation in our world, and it's made them want to be less involved with it every day in activism. They don't want to think about it or talk about it or to get out on the streets with pamphlets and campaign or table about it, I guess. The tips that we got from Mark Wolf and the writer of the book were things about staying positive and to allocate time for to do things that you enjoy, to keep yourself positive. Interestingly, he had one comment which was to stay fit, to exercise, and he mentioned part of that was that many people might not be familiar with seeing vegans and to be the best you can be, and part of that was being in good shape. And I was thinking, more social pressure, that's great. but he apparently enjoys exercise. Not everyone enjoys exercise as much as Mark Hawthorne, the author of the book, but it was generally to make time for yourself and to do things that you like to do and to know that you are making progress and we're all moving forward together. We're all in this together.
Yeah, it's interesting that. In fact, that thing about staying fit and looking good is what Ronnie said in his podcast. Ronnie Lee said that. I mean, he also said right at the end of that that one of the good reasons for that is that you stay in the fight longer, so presumably to avoid burnout. I think I was almost subject to burnout in the 80s, I think, because I, you know, all the weight of all this abuse kind of was on my shoulders. I remember I used to go past butcher shops and say sorry to the dead animals, you know. And people used to say, do you want to come to a party or go to a theatre and, you know, go see a movie? And I used to say, no, that's self-indulgent. And, you know, we'll do that when there's no more killing and there's no more rape. And then we'll have a proper party. Because whenever I used to go to those social events, it was spoilt by the fact that I remember what was going on in the real world, if you like, or in the outside world. But I think that it is true that you do have to create some space. So I think that's probably good advice. Do you say anything else about any more tips, Jordan?
Well, that's what I'd boil it down to, was just to always have space for yourself to make things that you enjoy doing, to surround yourself with positive people and to set yourself goals, small goals, and so you know that you're achieving things, that you are moving towards your end goal. And to celebrate it when you did, obviously, that there would be a big party. You can host it, Roger, the big party.
In podcast 14, Robin Lane, the co-founder of the London Vegan Festival, gave us his thoughts about the state of the present-day animal movement and the issue of burnout.
So, Robin, how would you assess the current status of veganism and animal rights worldwide? You have some historical perspective compared to some of us newbies, so could you give us a little bit of your view of that?
I think there's certainly been a rise in the amount of animal rights groups in other countries. In this country, there was, I mean, I know people talk about a peak that happened in this country around the 80s. Well, this peak's been going on for quite a while, but I think other groups have been springing up in other countries, especially in European countries and in America. And I think it's, you know, in Australia, it's very, very encouraging that the actual, you know, when you think about the animal rights movement, didn't really, you know, it's not really that old. It's actually, can trace it back probably to, certainly the modern animal rights movement, back to the 70s. I mean, it's incredible the progress that it's made in such a short space of time. And I think it's growing all the time.
That leads to one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Robin, which is, you're talking about how, you know, how young the movement is. And I think some animal activists forget that. I often say to people, well, you know, the Vegan Society, for example, it was only formed in 1944, which, you know, historically is a blink of an eye away. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, I tend to think that we're still in the kind of pioneer stage. Obviously, people like Donald Watson were the real pioneers, but we're still in the kind of pioneer stage. I often say that what's really needed is for us to lay a foundation down for the people who follow us. And the better we lay that foundation, then the less work those who follow us will have to do. But I was reading an interview you did about burnout, and you were saying, you were very optimistic. You were saying that you felt personally that you would never burn out. And at the same time, I'm sure that you probably know quite a few people who have. So I wonder whether I could kind of get you to kind of tease out your thoughts about burnout and, you know, why people do that. You know, do you think it's kind of false expectation that change will come, you know, so fast and then they get frustrated and then just kind of blow out like a candle?
I think, you know, what you said earlier was absolutely right. This movement is really in its genesis period, really. I think a lot of people, especially young people, I mean, when I got involved, I was still in my 20s, you do kind of think that things are going to happen pretty quickly. But if you think about the fact that it's taken thousands and tens of thousands of years to get to the state we're in now, it's hardly going to change in a few years. So I think a lot of people, I mean, I've seen a lot of people fall out of the movement, you know, a lot of people. And all the people that I was involved with in the 80s have all dropped out, actually. You know, it's a shame, really, that people don't see it, the bigger picture. And they just think, oh, it's not happening fast enough. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. Therefore, I'm not going to bother. You know, and I think that's such a big mistake. And we have to look in, you know, the very, very long term regarding animal rights. It's a very young movement so far, very young, and it's made tremendous progress in the last, you know, 40 years or something. It's just amazing, really.
I think a sociological understanding of what's going on really helps. In the sense that, bar a revolution, which nobody is kind of expecting, we're not in a kind of pre-revolutionary situation. So in those circumstances of non-revolution, if you like, then social change tends to be quite slow. And I think people do get frustrated by that. You know, we do tend to have all those numbers bouncing around in our heads, don't we? You know, every 6 seconds and all this kind of stuff. And we know about the slaughter figures, and we've seen those counters ticking off the deaths of non-humans, you know, second by second.
20 years ago, I mean, there's more animals being killed for the meat now and dairy now than there was 20 years ago. But I don't really see that. Oh, well, there's no point carrying on because there's more animals being killed now than there was then. I see that when we go out into the streets or when we do the festival, if we can get one person to become a vegan, then we've made a tremendous, you know, it's a great victory. And I've got this sort of this little saying of mine. It's like, we might be a drop in the ocean, but every drop makes a you know, can make a pond, or every pond can make a lake. And I think that's the best way of looking at it. Don't look from the enormity down. We look from the very smallest point up. And I think that's, and about burnout, regarding myself, no, I won't ever burn out, because over the last nearly 30 years, I've kept changing what I do. And I think that is really, really important, because everything I do is a fresh thing. I think a lot of people, they get stuck in this rut of not achieving what they think they can achieve. And so they just stop, rather than thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll go on to something different.
I think that's a wonderful attitude, Robin.
Yes, so do I, absolutely.
In podcast 17, our guest Bruce Friedrich, who had recently departed from PETA to work for Farm Sanctuary, was asked about the monitoring that would happen in the so-called colony cages he has promoted at an AR conference.
I don't think anybody would contest that a system wherein you cram 5 birds into 18 by 20 inches is a lot worse, both for the animals physiologically and psychologically, than a system wherein the stocking density is half and the cages are 20 times as big.
Could you address the speciesist in charge point? Because all these systems, no matter what they are, whether they're, and I'm glad that you acknowledge that the new systems won't be humane, which is often a claim that's made, and I acknowledge that you didn't say that. But in terms of who's going to operate them, it's going to be speciesists. And PETA themselves have published video after video of speciesists doing horrendous things to non-human victims. So in some senses, even in these new systems, there's nothing really much to protect them. In fact, you know, you almost wonder whether being in a cage away from these guys who can't use them as footballs, etc., might actually be an advantage sometimes. You see, the point I'm getting at is the fact that we're still leaving the non-humans in the hands of speciesists who don't care about them, and they're actually there to use them exploitatively, aren't they?
Oh, I totally agree with you, and I don't support these systems over, you know, veganism, which is what everybody who cares about animals should be eating a vegan diet. There's not such a thing as a humane commercial egg, period. And Farm Sanctuary, obviously, as well as PETA, vigorously advocates veganism and no cages at all. But we don't shy away from saying that colony cages are preferable to battery cages, because they are. And you're absolutely right that the animals, I mean, all of the male babies are still going to be tossed alive into grinders. All of these hens are still going to have their beaks seared off with a hot blade, which causes chronic pain that lasts up to a month if it doesn't kill the animals from the shock, as it often does. All of these animals are going to be shipped to slaughter when they're not even 2 years old. So the level of abuse is going to be significant. But again, if you think about this from the perspective of the animals involved, assuming that we're not going to be able to save all of these animals, I think there is real value in getting them out of battery cages, because colony cages, from the perspective of the animals involved, represent a significant improvement.
In podcast 15, I asked Oscar about the dramatic animal equality performance in which animal activists hold the dead bodies of other animals and invite people to learn about those they exploit. And Jason asked a question about effective protests in general. Do you have an opinion on that in general?
Well, I think it was very, very effective. They've been doing it for some years now, and I think they will continue doing it with more and more activists. They expect to have several hundred activists performing it this year too, and I think it's very, very effective, because it's very, very emotional and it gets huge media attention. And I think it's very, very, I mean, it's a very straightforward one, because it's very, very simple. You don't have to like explain it. I mean, it's just like, look, here they are, the animals, they are killed, and why are they killed? Well, because we are using them. So make the connection. So yeah, I think the action, that performance is brilliant, yeah.
Was there much of a negative reaction to that protest that you're aware of? I remember reading at the time that a lot of the parents who had young children at the protest would be lying to their young children and saying that the bodies were not real dead bodies of the other animals, that they were just pretending, they were...
That the animals were sleeping, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happened, but that it were just some particular, very specific cases. I mean, in general, the reaction was very, very positive. And even in those cases, even if the parents were somehow, you know, in an uncomfortable situation, that was because the kids were somehow, you know, empathizing with the animals, which is good, which is actually what these events try to achieve.
Absolutely.
What kind of protests do you think are effective, both in terms of what to protest and how to protest?
As I said when we had the chat session, I think that there are three main approaches to ending the use of animals. And these approaches are, first, you may try to make it illegal to use animals. Second, you may try to make it impossible for those who produce animal products to do so. And third, you may try to change people's minds. So I think that the third approach is the best one, and I think it's the one that will succeed, rather than the other ones. I think that the other ones can be maybe complementary at some point, but that this is the one that will really, really achieve the aims we want to attain.
In podcast 19, we invited sociologists David Nybert and Helen Masterman-Smith to discuss, in part, the idea of alliance politics. Here is a section of their interesting interview.
From where I'm standing here in rural New South Wales in Australia, and as a trade union participant and activist, the question that's kind of been on my mind and the conversations we're having are around what sort of lessons we can learn for the future from Indigenous Australians, from movements in the Global South. And in particular, I'm thinking about and have been talking with people about the developments in the World Social Forum, as well as the Earth Charter coming out of Bolivia in the past few years. And the appeal in those sorts of communities, and I don't want to romanticise them or you know, suggest that they're homogenous worldviews or anything like that, or unchanging traditional cultures. But the thing that is interesting to me from those movements is that they take what might be broadly described as an ecocentric frame. So they're essentially looking at the interdependence of humans and other animals, as well as the environment more broadly, and trying to think about what an ecocentric world rather than an anthropocentric world might look like. And, you know, there's a lot of communities in poorer parts of the world, and even in poorer parts of Australia for that matter, who are trying to have, in the Australian context, for example, Indigenous Australians have been trying to hold on to an ethic of what they call caring for country. And by country, they don't just mean land, they mean the ecological, the ecosystem more broadly, which they have both a material and an emotional and a spiritual relationship with. So I think that there are elements of that kind of effective community relationships with nature that, if in terms of thinking about the future, I think have to be an essential component. So while there are certainly appealing elements in a sort of socialist framework, etc., I think for the average person and thinking about the future, that we need to find a way to break through those ideological constraints and that David talks about in his book, where we're steeped, both our civilizations in the West particularly, and personally our experiences of socialization, you know, from cradle to grave, are about human-first thinking. And the trade union movement is very much, you know, a part of that cultural and political economic apparatus, and is a very anthropocentric orientated movement. But we do have members in my union, for example, we have a strong Indigenous presence. And, you know, just as an illustration of this, they've recently put out, our Indigenous section of our union have recently put out a report on racism, and they talk about the way in which they still, you know, routinely experience institutionalised racism. And I think one of the facets of that is that we have Indigenous people, students, as well as staff coming into the higher education sector who have been socialised and brought up in a culture which has for the most part, still tries to hold on to a reverence for nature and non-human parts of nature, other animals, etc. And they come into institutions that devalue that perspective of the world. So in thinking about the future, one of the things I'm grappling with as both a scholar and an activist is how to bring, you know, what on earth would an ecocentric world of work look like, for example? How would we relate to one another differently?
I really liked your response, and I guess one of the things that I really liked back in 1999 when there were protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, there was a large groups of students and trade unionists, but there was a good representation of Indigenous peoples from other parts of the world, and there was the beginning of a linking of hands and the beginning of a dialogue. So that had great promise, and then tragically, on September 11th, 2001, there was this great, it was a tragedy in so many ways, but this movement and movements for justice were subverted with this war on terror, and then the U.S. basically going into these military adventures into the Middle East when a lot of the world was against it. So that really set activists back in the United States for some time. But as we noted earlier, now we're beginning, at least 10 years later, it looks like we're beginning to pick up again, and the movement may be going forward. But I guess my hope would be that if we could transcend capitalism and move toward a system that was more democratically controlled, then Indigenous voices, you know, could be heard, and the dialogue would be much more extensive than what it is right now when the media is controlled by a relatively few powerful corporations.
I As some of you may know, AR Zone have recently begun our Find the Dang competition. Let me explain this idea further. In podcast number 5, Dr. Will Tuttle expressed his utter dismay about the then breaking news of a Humane Society of the United States and United Egg Producers partnership by uttering an uncharacteristically harsh word. He said dang. We, of course, were flabbergasted. But now we challenge all of our AR Zone listeners to find the hidden dang. In each new podcast, somewhere, you'll hear Dr. Tuttle say dang. What you'll be listening for is this.
Dang, 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 dang.
If you find a hidden dang, send an email to carolyn@arzone.net telling me the podcast number and the exact time in the recording where the dang is hidden. We'll draw one name from all the correct entries and send you a gift as our thanks for listening and playing along. A special thanks to Dr. Tuttle for graciously allowing us to present this contest.
Dang, 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 dang. You bet, you're gonna do it, right. Dang. 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 Dang.
Dang. In podcast 13, I mentioned to Thomas Yannick that he's been referred to as Dr. Doolittle. You said that you would sit in front of the snake's enclosure and watch them and try to communicate with them. I've heard people refer to you as Dr. Doolittle. Because you speak with other animals?
Yeah. Well, obviously, I'm an animal psychologist. So my language oftentimes is really body language and how to convey to animal things that they would convey to one another without language. Because everybody expects a dog to speak English somehow. And I said to people, like, I only speak broken English. And I actually had people thinking that I talk to my dog in German because it's German Shepherd. This is how far that goes. And I always say to people, like, why do you, because people give out when the dog doesn't understand. And I say, like, why don't you just, because I work with traumatized animals a lot. So let's just say someone hit a dog, and it's usually blokes that hit the dog. So if I go in, just like anybody else, approaching him from the front, the dog thinks, oh, I've been there before. I can't trust this guy. So in the wild, if you want to convey to a wolf, which they are, in essence, still are, you would go sideways or backwards. So it would show you, the animal sort of the back and would say, like, I'm not here to fight you. Mm-hmm. So I go in there, slightly backwards, and the dog understands automatically, this guy is not going to hit me. And I always say to people, I don't know if you can actually use that for your interview here, but I also say to people, if it's just about logical thing, if the dog really was aggressive, he bites my bum, not my dick. So it's a double whammy. But seriously, I mean, I trained people for the from the Blue Cross. They all the helpers, because the vet has no time, and you meet an animal on a very bad day, and you can't hold an animal down and then look into his eyes and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, it needs to be done," because when you use that voice, you keep the animal in that state. You say it's okay to be angry, and it's okay to be afraid. So I would make. I would tilt my head. I would stick out my tongue, which means everything is okay here, which is animal communication, body language. And in 9 years of doing this, I've never been bitten. But shamanically, what you do is you sit in front of that enclosure, wherever you are, even in a field with these animals, and you connect to nature. So before you actually do communication, you have to connect with the soil. So it's a meditation that I do then, and I remind myself that I'm from this earth. So therefore you connect with the earth, and because you calm down that way, and oftentimes very skittish animals like horses or deer tend to not run away any longer. And then you really try to convey mentally why you're here for. And funnily enough, a lot of animals responded to the messages that you sent mentally. And I noticed that I believe that at some stage we could all convey. I think it's our arrogance that thinks because we can't really read them well, and they don't use language, and they have sex in public and all that kind of stuff, that they're somehow silly. I think they are very advanced when it comes to their form of communication, because I always, even when I talk to so-called experts, I asked a guy once, a wolf, I studied wolves. And I asked the guy once of my teachers, I said, like, so how does the wolf in the back know that they all turn left? How does this happen? Because he can't even see them. So it's not if the other wolf in front of me turns left, I turn left, because they would run into trees otherwise. So someone must somehow tell them that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they have no explanation because there's no way to measure it. And if it's scientifically not measurable, then it can't be true. And that's what I'm usually opposing. I mean, I study ornithology at the moment because I deal more and more with birds. And I just read today that back in the medieval times, people really believed that swifts would spend half all winter on the bottom of the lake for just being there over winter. And then when they came back, it would herald the arrival of spring. And people believed it because they had heard somewhere from some expert that apparently all birds are waterproof. Obviously, it's not true, but people believed it. You know.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So the Irish called me Dr. Doolittle, simply because I was surprised as anyone else. All of a sudden, people said, "Oh yeah, you were in the papers." See, Ireland is very small. So every time you're in the papers, television stations call you up. They're saying, like, I saw you in the papers, it's Eddie Murphy. I said, I have never met him. You know? There's a picture of you and Eddie Murphy. Said, huh? And then they talked to me about Dr. Doolittle. And they would announce me like this. And all of a sudden, I became a pet psychic. And then Yvette Fielding, big star in the UK, rang me up once because she had a show here in Birmingham, actually, before I moved here, a paranormal show. And they asked me if I could come over and explain animal communication to them. And it was a great show, and they were actually great people. They were really down to earth, which surprised me. I liked them a lot. But the very fact that it could be seen as a psychic phenomenon always blows my mind. But of course, I would absolutely go along with it because, you know, every time I would have a client, I could help an animal. So I wouldn't really care what label they gave me.
When I was new to the movement, Meet Your Meat had a profound effect on me. I asked guest Bruce Friedrich about this film in podcast number 17, and it transpired that its powerful impact on viewers comes from the fact that they had decided to only include footage of the standard and routine use and abuse of other animals, as you'll hear Bruce explain in his answer. Bruce, could you please tell our listeners about your involvement with the film Meet Your Meat and also about the effects the film has had on people? It was instrumental in me becoming vegan myself, and I wonder what the process of creating the film was like, what your inspiration for it was, and the reaction that you've had to it over the years.
Back in 1996, Alex Pacheco put together a video that he called The Diner for a national animal rights conference, and it was a bunch of gruesome footage of cruelty to farmed animals. And Jem Aiken and I don't know what we basically wanted to remove anything that was anathema, because obviously some people would look at it and say, you know, that never happens, or that was, you know, not routine or whatever. Mm. So Jem and I were chatting about what we could do to make it more effective, and we decided that we wanted to take out any of the stuff that should be prosecutable, anything that's not standard. And then we thought that it would make sense to sort of go animal by animal and look for as much footage as we could find of all of the standard agricultural cruelties. And we had done quite a few undercover investigations and had a lot of footage of things that we hadn't released because they were standard. Usually, you know, that was there wasn't much reliance on internet. It wasn't as easy to get footage out back then. Right. So we had a lot of footage that we hadn't used. Jem and I spliced it together. The first version of Meet Your Meat did not have narration because the diner didn't have narration. So we just had music and all of the cruelty with little slides that sort of came up to introduce each of the practices. And then I think it was a couple years later, we asked Alec Baldwin if he would narrate it. And we wrote the script, and he did, in fact, narrate it. He punched up the script. He made a lot of very useful changes on the basis of his knowledge and compassion.
Do you think one of the reasons that it's been, well, in my opinion, it's been really effective, do you think one of the reasons for that is because, like you say, you've kind of used standard footage? It sort of shows that these practices that are in the film are standard procedure?
I think that's certainly a part of it. I think a lot of the reason it's been successful is that the internet exists, mm-hmm. as well. More than 1 million people see it every single year. So where previously, if you wanted a million people to see cruelty footage, well, you just couldn't. No national news networks would air cruelty footage, so there just wasn't a way to get it to people. So I would say the advent of the internet has allowed us to put that sort of footage in front of people, which is the reason that it's been so successful. And I think the Glass Walls video is actually even a little bit better. Both PETA's Glass Walls video, which people can see at Meet Your Meat, and also the Mercy for Animals Farm to Fridge video, both of them include a bit more information about animal sentience, and both of them include fish, which we didn't have enough fish footage, so we made a conscious decision to leave fish out of Meet Your Meat, just because the fish section would have been like 10 seconds long. But we've subsequently been able to get enough footage to put together a very impacting section on why not to eat fish as well. And that's in the Glass Walls video that Paul McCartney narrates. And Mercy for Animals has put it into their Farm to Fridge video, which James Cromwell narrates.
Our podcast 19B is entitled Entanglements of Oppression and Liberation, Part 2. In this extract, David Nybert speaks about the Occupy campaigners and cheese pizzas. Whereas many other movements won't incorporate the end of exploitation of other animals as part of their philosophy.
Like I said earlier, I was much encouraged by the Occupy Wall Street movement that started several weeks ago and has spread to many parts of the world. And if it weren't for teaching and trying to take care of a household of rescued animals, some of whom have various ailments, and trying to finish some other obligations, I would be there with them. But I was very discouraged, you know, when their food of choice is cheese pizza. And, and people were, you know, sending them all this money, and they were getting all these cheese pizzas delivered. So I guess in one sense, if I was there, I would be occupying the square with them, but I would be holding a sign and talking to them about, you know, the implications of eating that cheese pizza, you know, for themselves, for the animals, for the environment. So, and if I were able to go, you know, I would raise that issue, but I think I would stand with them in standing against capitalism, but I think I would turn my back when they were eating their cheese pizzas, and I would argue with them. So in terms of entering into agreements or manifestos, I think that would be problematic. But if there's a group standing up against racism or sexism or capitalism, I'll march with them that day. But we may have some more difficult struggles because, again, I think half-stepping and particular welfarist types of reforms, you know, which in the past I participated in and now I very much regret, especially at my own university. I helped to establish an IACUC, an Animal Care and Use Committee, and that has actually increased the amount of animal experimentation going on there. So, it's very difficult. I think we need to stand with our brothers and sisters around the world, especially in challenging capitalism, but we need to engage them in some hard conversations about animal oppression.
Yeah, I agree, David. And in actual fact, there has been some coverage of vegan perspectives on the Occupy Wall Street. In fact, I think I posted something on my Facebook wall from the Vegan Animal Liberation Alliance, it was called. And there was a blog entry called Occupy Wall Street, A Vegan Perspective. And I think that was based on the idea of supporting them and yet taking them on on that issue.
Very good. I'm happy to hear that.
I saw that blog post as well, Roger, and found it quite interesting. And I think I might have posted a link to it on AR Zone, actually. And in the occupations that are happening in Australia at the moment, there was also another post from one of the AR Zone members from Occupy Adelaide. And she's apparently sending out flyers and to try and raise these issues, you know, presumably taking much the same approach that David's just outlined. And I've certainly raised it, although I'm not physically there at Occupy Sydney. I was there on the first day, but I live 5 hours from Sydney, so I'm not there on a permanent basis. But I've certainly been trying to keep that issue on the agenda and saying, well, the recognition of the exploitation of non-human animals is recorded in the New York Declaration at Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, please make sure that we don't lose sight of these issues as well. And, you know, I deliberately made a point of donating fruit to the to the occupation to encourage different eating practices. And, you know, we all know pizza's no good for them anyway. So
on that declaration, Helen, are you saying, is that bit where it says something about we have poisoned the food supply through negligence, undermined the farming system through monopolization, we have profited off the torture, confinement and cruel treatment of countless animals and actively hide these practices? Yeah, that's part of the – it's kind of like an official declaration, isn't it?
It is the Declaration of Grievances. And so I was – you know, looking to see whether or not these questions, when Occupy Wall Street first started happening, you know, and I, like a lot of people, was glued to my live stream watching it all. And so I was really surprised, actually, to see that there was anything in there about, in the declaration, about non-human animals. And I sort of figured, well, obviously someone or some group of people are in there. And I did also note that they had an animal rights working group. So it's obviously not just one person, you know, rattling the can.
In podcast 14, Ronnie asks Robin Lane about political campaigning.
Robin, do you think political campaigning is worthwhile? In other words, is it useful for people to become involved in trying to promote legislation to protect animals and trying to possibly get political parties elected that may be more sympathetic to animal protection? Is that a worthwhile effort for people who are concerned about animals to carry out?
Well, I think the problem with political campaigning is that governments will never allow anything that will conflict with big business and banks and investments in banks and things. And I think it's not really political parties that run countries. It's really big business, the people with the money. And I think, political campaigning is all very well within itself. And I think if it can draw maybe people away from voting for the Conservatives or the Labour Party or whoever, or the Lib Dems, that's one thing. But if Animal Protection Party or Animals Count, and I have supported them in the past, but I think if they actually did get anywhere on the political spectrum, they would soon not find they weren't able to do the things that they actually were campaigning for in the first place. I mean, that might sound very cynical, but I think really the world is very cynical when it comes to animal exploitation. And really, the whole of society is built on it. And no government and no moneyed corporation or equity company or whatever is going to allow an animal rights political party to actually make any progress. That's my personal opinion anyway.
Yeah, just one that I would agree strongly with. I think Ronnie might differ with that. But
yeah, I mean, my view is that single issue political parties are never going to be able to form a government. So my view is that the Green Party is the only hope.
In podcast 16, Barbara and Roger talk about their podcast with Jordan Wyatt on the subject of Iron Brian, a pro-animal use propaganda program that occurs in New Zealand.
And just to share with everyone, we had seen a clip sent by Jordan Wyatt of a character named Iron Brian that was being introduced in the New Zealand schools. Iron Brian is a character that's a living cartoon character, is a big, tall person dressed up in a cartoon costume coming to the schools in a highly decorated van with lots of literature and food handouts and a wild song with music and lots of bells and whistles. So we were looking at how we as animal advocates can counteract the kind of speciesism and the kind of promotional materials that the animal abusers have on their side.
Didn't they actually have a barbecue as part of the vans that they went around, Barbara?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember part of the little song that he sings, and the kids were just screaming with delight as they're walking around and handing things to him.
Yeah, he was like a celebrity, wasn't he?
Right. And he said that he brushes his teeth with a file, and after he eats his beef and lamb, he runs a 3-minute mile. So there's a lot of hype about the power and the joy of abusing animals. It was pretty horrific. And boy, were those kids buying into it, too. It's an interesting combination of machinery and humanity and superhero in that character.
A kind of fantasy figure in a way, isn't it? So
yeah, but it's frightening because that's kind of what we're doing with the animals. It's like factory farming, kind of a machinery and animals, the living being and the machinery combined. And it just reminded me that the same parallel with Iron Brian, and they're showing this man who's part machine, has a computer for a brain, no feeling involved. It just reminds me of the same kind of thing. What we try to do with animals is depersonalize them into, you know, widgets on the assembly or the disassembly line.
That brings us to the end of this, our second AR Zone Greatest Hits podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it and look forward to hearing any feedback you'd like to give. Don't forget to check out our main AR Zone site at www.arzone.net and keep an eye out for more upcoming podcasts. Bye for now.